All right, today in our study of Deuteronomy, we come to Deuteronomy chapter 2, which I'm going to read. We split Deuteronomy 1 into two lessons, so it maybe didn't look as long. This chapter is not as long as Deuteronomy 1, but it's still fairly lengthy, but I think it'll be good to read it and get a sense of what's going on before we look at the particulars. So remember the context. They had just refused to enter the promised land, refused to enter into battle at Kadesh Barnea, and then changed their mind and decided they would, but they were doomed then to wander for roughly 40 years. And that's where Deuteronomy 2 picks up. Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness of the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and we skirted Mount Seir for many days. And the Lord spoke to me, saying, "You have skirted this mountain long enough. Turn northward and command the people, saying, 'You are about to pass through the territory of your brethren, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir, and they will be afraid of you. Therefore, watch yourselves carefully. Do not meddle with them, for I will not give you any of their land, no, not so much as one footstep, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. You shall buy food from them with money, that you may eat, and you shall also buy water from them with money that you may drink. For the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hand. He knows your trudging through this great wilderness. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you. You have lacked nothing." And when we pass beyond our brethren, the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir, away from the road of the plain, away from Elath and Ezion-Geber, we turned and passed by way of the wilderness of Moab. Then the Lord said to me, "Do not harass Moab, nor contend with them in battle, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given Ar to the descendants of Lot as a possession. The Emim have dwelt there in times past, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. They were also regarded as giants like the Anakim, but the Moabites called them Emim. The Horites formerly dwelt in Seir, but the descendants of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and dwelt in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. Now rise and cross over the valley of the Zered." So we crossed over the valley of the Zered. And the time we took to come from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over the valley of the Zered was 38 years, until all the generation of the men of war was consumed from the midst of the camp, just as the Lord had sworn to them. For indeed the hand of the Lord was against them, to destroy them from the midst of the camp until they were consumed. So it was, when all the men of war had finally perished from among the people, that the Lord spoke to me, saying, "This day you are to cross over at Ar, the boundary of Moab, and when you come near the people of Ammon, do not harass them or meddle with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the descendants of Lot as a possession. That was also regarded as a land of giants. Giants formerly dwelt there. But the Ammonites call them Zamzumim, a people as great and numerous and tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before them, and they possessed them and dwelt in their place, just as he had done for the descendants of Esau, who dwelt in Seir, when he destroyed the Horites from before them. They dispossessed them and dwelt in their place, even to this day. And the Avim, who dwelt in villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them and dwelt in their place. Rise, take your journey, and cross over the river Arnon. Look, I have given into your hands Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his land. Begin to possess it and engage him in battle. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. And I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, king of Heshbon, with words of peace, saying, "Let me pass through your land. I will keep strictly to the road, and I will turn neither to the right nor to the left. You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, just as the descendants of Esau who dwell in Seir and the Moabites who dwell in Ar did for me, until I cross the Jordan to the land which the Lord our God is giving us." But Sihon, king of Heshbon, would not let us pass through. For the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate, that he might deliver him into your hand as it is this day. And the Lord said to me, See, I have given Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to possess it that you may inherit his land. Then Sihon and all his people came out against us to fight at Jahaz. And the Lord our God delivered him over to us, so we defeated him, his sons, and all his people. We took all his cities at that time, and we utterly destroyed the men, women, and little ones of every city. We left none remaining. We took only the livestock as plunder for ourselves, which with the spoil of the cities which we took. From Aroer, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, from the city that is in the ravine, as far as Gilead, there was not one city too strong for us. The Lord our God delivered all to us. Only you did not go near the land of the people of Ammon, anywhere along the river Jabbok, or to the cities of the mountains, or wherever the Lord our God had forbidden us. Now, there are a lot of interesting names in that chapter, and you may wonder what the relevance of that is to the rest of scriptural teaching. I hope the long list of scripture references on the board will correct that misimpression up front. It is kind of amazing how closely tied, especially the events of these opening chapters of Deuteronomy, are to the rest of biblical history. And I hope I can make that plain as we go along. So we saw last week, as I mentioned before, that the people refused to enter in. It wasn't simply a failure of nerve, but it was characterized in Deuteronomy and elsewhere in the book of Hebrews as unbelief. It was by faith that they were to look back to what God had done before for them and to look forward to the promises that he was to give them. And they were to exercise that faith then in obedience, which would go into the land in spite of the tremendous obstacles. We saw last week from the book of Hebrews how that's our lot also, looking forward to the promised eternal land, the new heavens and the new earth, that we are to live by faith and fight our battles by faith. Here, one way, I suppose, to outline the chapter, chapter 2, would be to say there is the end of wandering. There are three non-battles and one battle. How's that? Okay, there are three nations they're not supposed to fight, and one they do enter into a fight with. But I think as we go along, as I've already mentioned, we'll see the significance of those non-battles and the one battle. First of all, let's look briefly at the way the opening verses describe the end of the wandering period. That wandering period is spelled out further in the book of Numbers. We noted last week it was, I guess, roughly in the middle of Numbers that the event at Kadesh Barnea occurred. But here, here Moses simply summarizes this in verse 1 of chapter 2. We skirted Mount Seir for many days. And then there said they've skirted the mountain long enough, turned northward. And then, as we saw in the reading in verses 14 and 15, there's a brief description of, thanks, Vicki, of the end of that generation. And one consequence of that is that the people are now willing to fight. Okay, this was a generation that rebelled against God, that refused to believe, and they're dead. And now there's a new generation. And part of the lesson of the chapter is that God, by patient training over 40 years, roughly, has prepared them for the battle to come. So let's look a little bit at the three nations they're told not to fight. Okay, so you need to have in your head a little bit of the geography of Canaan. Remember, Kadesh Barnea was on the south side of the land, and they refused to enter there. They wandered around quite a while in the desert. It's not clear exactly where all they went, but they went nowhere fast, as the phrase goes, I guess. And in the end, they ended up on the southeast side of the land of Canaan. So if you look in one of your maps in the Bible, you might see that on the southeast side of the land of Canaan is what's usually called Edom. Here it's referred to as Seir. But Edom and Seir or Mount Seir, basically the same place on the southeast side of Canaan. And then as you go northward from Edom, there's Moab and then Ammon. Okay, so those are the three nations they're told not to fight. They're on the eastern side, or ranging from southeastern to northeastern side of the land of Canaan. And they're not to engage them in battle. They're not part, strictly speaking, of the promised land, although we'll come back to that point in a minute. Now, Edom Okay, so as you, I guess, know, or as mentioned here, Edom was the land of the descendants of Esau. Esau was the brother of Jacob, and that's why here they're referred to as your brethren in verse 4. Okay, so obviously they're not literally their brothers, not even cousins, but Jacob and Esau were brothers, they're descendants of Jacob, and that's one of the connections that's given here. And notice the emphasis that their land was given to them by God. Verse 5, I have given Mount Seir to Esau as a possession. We're going to see a pattern with that. They can trade with them, so they can say, in verse 6, buy food and water from them, but they're not allowed to attack them. Now, actually, what happened in the end is that Edom refused them passage. So they didn't go through, perhaps, on the preferred route, but on a route that more skirted the property or the land of Edom. That's in Numbers 20, the first reference I put on the board. Let's look at the reasons given a little bit more in detail. The reasons that are given here for Edom are repeated more or less for, in terms of Ammon and Moab. And okay, this looks rather obscure, but there are actually some important points here. Why was it they weren't allowed to enter into Edom? Well, first, kinship, which we've already mentioned. So they were related as nations. Second of all, God's goodness to them. Notice in verse 7, the Lord your God has blessed you. God has provided for you for 40 years. You have lacked nothing. There's no need for you to raid Edom and take their goods because God has been good to you. Now that's consistent with a theme that we've seen already emphasized in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Again and again, God emphasizes in these opening chapters, before he gives them the law, that he is a kind and good and gracious overlord, if you want to look in the political terms, in terms of like a treaty. He has provided for them. So that's another point of emphasis. But maybe the most interesting one is this idea of God's sovereign allocation of lands. I don't know that we usually think that way, but the passage emphasizes that God's the one who, if you will, doles out the property. We're used to the idea that God gave the Israelites the promised land. We may not be used to thinking of the fact that God gave the descendants of Esau what they had. And as you trace through in the references to Ammon and Moab, you see the same thing. So I'm not going to go into detail there. Certainly not going to talk about the Zamzumim. You'll have to do some research on that on your own. But just to remind you that Ammon and Moab were descended from Lot. Lot was a nephew of Abraham. These two nations were descended from Lot by his daughters, so they were the product of incest. It was after the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in a similar way, God says, I gave Ammon their land and I gave Moab their land. Don't mess with them. Okay? So this is a sort of an interesting point because later on in the nation's history, at least twice, the same question comes up. If you look at Judges 11 and also 2 Chronicles 20, there are sort of counterclaims like they say, when you came through Israel, you took some of our land. And Jephthah has to say in Judges 11, well, no, you know, go back and read Deuteronomy. Essentially, that's not what happened. And later on, in fact, in 2 Chronicles 20, the three nations tried to dispossess Israel, in spite of the fact that they had refused to dispossess those three nations when they entered the promised land. So this idea that God allocates the land that a nation holds is actually a surprisingly common theme in the scriptures. I put up references in Genesis 10 and 11. That's at the very beginning of biblical history. It sort of bridges the Tower of Babel and the scattering of the nations. But there's a table of nations in Genesis 10, and then the scattering of nations in Genesis 11. Later on in Deuteronomy, the same idea that God gives the nations their properties, reference in Job. Acts 17:26, maybe more familiar in Paul's sermon on Mars Hill. And it's from the point of view of this book, the main lesson we should remember is God's sovereignty. Okay? God is sovereign over all the nations of the earth. And that means that God can dispossess the Canaanites, which he's about to do, and give their land to Israel. We'll get to that. But God can assign other nations their possession. So nations tend to think of themselves as sovereign, right? We are a sovereign nation. But they tend to forget that actually God is the sovereign over all the nations of the earth. It's a helpful lesson for nations to remember. For one thing, it should be a helpful lesson for all of us to remember to be content. Okay, if we want to go from the national level to the personal level, we need to be reminded that God also assigns to us what we have. Now, everyone realizes that we are expected to work and God can bless the work of our hands. That's actually what God says of the Israelites here. But many times it's a lack of contentment that causes people to chafe at what God has given them. That's true on the level of the individual. It's true on the level of the church. It's also true on the level of the nation. It's quite striking. Calvin has in his sermons on this passage quite a bit to say about the tendency of princes to want to conquer other nations. Okay, this is 500 years ago, of course, for Calvin. This is not a new problem, okay? And they also tend to tell their people in the nation that it's going to benefit them when it actually doesn't really benefit them that much. But even nations need to learn to be content. Now, God can raise up one nation and cast down another. He can dispossess one and give to another. But part of the lesson of this is the reminder that God is the one who sovereignly gives out the nations of the earth. Now, I want to draw in here some further thoughts that are suggested by this provision of God in Deuteronomy 2:7. So before I pause there and see if there are any comments on this idea of, you know, national sovereignty, we can talk about neoconservatives and conservatives and all that sort of thing. But there is an interesting connection between the wandering of the people, which is brought up here not only in the verses we looked at in 2:14 and 15, but in terms of God's provision in verses 6 and 7, that God blessed them, God knows you're trudging through this great wilderness and these 40 years. I mentioned last week that the lesson of the 40 years is emphasized throughout the scriptures, and we looked especially at Hebrews, where the wilderness wandering is connected with the unbelief of the people, and the promised land is connected for us with the new heavens and the new earth, the inheritance we will receive from God. But there's a much richer connections. There are more connections that are made than that, and I wanted to look at just one of them. So I'll skip over, just for your further reading, if you like, you could look at Revelation 12, where the idea is that God provides for his church in the wilderness. But instead of looking at that, let's turn to Luke chapter 4. So I'm using this passage as a sort of a jumping off point to think again of the wilderness wanderings, which are fairly compressed in terms of the description in Deuteronomy. And the way God uses that picture, that imagery in biblical history to cause us to think of the things that God does for his people. And here the striking thing is that Christ himself is viewed as, if you will, wandering in the wilderness. I mentioned when we talked about the law in the first week that obviously the law in Deuteronomy is given to instruct us about our own obligation. But the law is also given to remind us of the perfect obedience of Christ. And the wilderness wanderings, I'm not going to be saying those two words together anymore. The wanderings in the wilderness are also there as a type of what Christ has done for us. So look at, did I say Matthew or Luke?
Luke,
thank you. Okay. They're both in, one's in Matthew 4 and the other's in Luke 4. It doesn't make that much difference, but let's look at Luke 4. You remember when Jesus had just been baptized, so there's a genealogy in between, but if you go back up to verse 22, say, of chapter 3, Jesus is baptized, a voice declares, "You are my beloved Son." And then what immediately follows in Luke 4 is Jesus being driven into the wilderness to be tempted. And if you read this passage and meditate on the imagery and the language that's used, you'll see there are a lot of connections with the description of the wandering in the wilderness and even in the use of the book of Deuteronomy. So I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that when Jesus is tempted three times, each time he responds with scripture, right? Well, all three of those scriptures are from Deuteronomy. And in fact, all three of those scriptures from Deuteronomy are connected with temptations the nation of Israel expected when they were wandering. Okay? So, for example, verse 6, Jesus says, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God." Well, that's a quotation from Deuteronomy 8, where God is reminding them that he provided for them in the wilderness. Okay, just what we read about in Deuteronomy 2. And the point of this is that Jesus is pictured as undergoing temptation the way the nation did. But where the nation failed, Jesus perfectly obeyed. And here Jesus is a type not only of the nation of Israel, but of Adam himself. You notice in the way the genealogy culminates in verse 38 of chapter 3, Seth, and then he is described as, then Adam, who is described as the Son of God. Of course, in the context, Jesus has just been called the Son of God at his baptism. And Jesus here is the faithful Son of God. Unlike Adam, Jesus perfectly obeys. Adam was tempted in a garden and failed. Jesus was tempted in the wilderness and obeyed. And here, Jesus identifies himself with the people of Israel. He went into the wilderness to be tempted the way they were, but he perfectly obeyed. As one commentary says, the disobedience of Israel is evoked, and that's by means of all the wilderness imagery here, is evoked to highlight the perfect obedience of Jesus as God's faithful Son. So it's important for us when we think of the 40 years not only to think of the failure of the nation and not only to think of the call to faith in Hebrews, but also to think of the one who has guaranteed salvation for us, right? Otherwise, our wandering is in vain because we're not going to enter the promised land. But because Jesus perfectly obeyed in the face of temptation, he has secured salvation. And strikingly, actually, at the end of that passage in Hebrews 4 that we looked at last week is the famous statement, Jesus has been tempted in every way like we have. Right? He knows our temptations. He has been tempted just as we have, Hebrews 4, 14 through 16, falling right on the heels of the writer's description of the failures of the generation of Moses who rebelled in the wilderness. So I want you to keep in mind as you think, even as we go later on in Deuteronomy, and we'll come to the other references. I mentioned the one in Deuteronomy 8 on the board somewhere. Yeah, Deuteronomy 8, 3. The other two are in Deuteronomy 6, 13 and 16. Lord willing, when we get to those, we'll reflect again on the fact that Jesus is really the perfect Israel. He is the true suffering servant. He obeys where the Old Testament people failed, and that to be our Savior. One other comment I thought I would make in terms of the end of the wandering and the inheritance of the land. It's quite a contrast, and it's in the book of Deuteronomy, it's compressed, as I noted, in Numbers, it's spread out over several chapters. But at the beginning of Deuteronomy 2, they're wandering, and by the end of Deuteronomy 2, they have an inheritance. Now, it's the inheritance of Sihon, so it's on the other side of Jordan, but they've suddenly entered into what you would call cultivated lands as opposed to the wilderness. And Matthew Henry makes this comment that's, I think, very fitting for us to think about in terms of that striking change. What a new world did Israel now come into. Most of them were born and had lived all their days in a vast, howling wilderness where they knew not what either fields or cities were, had no houses to dwell in, and neither sowed nor reaped. And now, of a sudden, to become masters of a country so well built, so well husbanded, this made them amends for their long waiting, and yet it was but the earnest of a great deal more. This again emphasizes well, I think, the provision of God for them, even on the edge of the promised land, that they take over the land of Sihon, which is ready for them to use. Let me pause here and see if you have any comments or questions, any thoughts about that. This is the pacifist part of the chapter. Don't fight those guys. They were about to utterly annihilate the Amorites, so you can make peace and not war now. Any comments or questions? Okay. What a docile group. All right, so now we're going to go to battle then to stir you guys up. They're told not to fight against these three nations, the Edomites, the Ammonites, and the Moabites. And now they are told that the conquest is going to begin. So if you look over to verse 24, there's the command, "Rise, take your journey, and cross over the river Arnon." Now this is not crossing the river Jordan. This is not the promised land proper, you might say. Actually, Moses is preaching on the edge of the promised land proper, but what's usually referred to as Canaan. Yet the boundary description that's given for the inheritance of Abraham's descendants usually extends from the sea to the river, from the Mediterranean to the river Euphrates, and that would certainly include the land of the Amorites that we're about to talk about. In any case, that land has been given to them, and that's the point of this. Here is mentioned Sihon, who's an Amorite. The Amorites were one of the peoples that inhabited that area in the list of 7 or 10 ites that you often hear about. Rick Gamble, in reading at the seminary, he's a professor at the seminary, in a seminar this summer at the international conference, listed the ites and included the mosquito bites. I mean, this is a guy, you know, world-renowned scholar, and he made fun of all the ites. Anyway, the Amorites are one of the ites. And there are repeated lists of them, those whom the nation of Israel will dispossess. And Sihon is usually mentioned in connection with Og. Okay, and that's Og is, I don't know why his parents named him that, but at the beginning of chapter 3, so that's in the next chapter, Og, king of Bashan. So usually Sihon and Og are mentioned together. And this is one of the facts that, until you sort of sit down and think about it, you don't realize how often the conquest of these two kings is mentioned in the Bible. So I put up a list here, starting with Numbers 21, and then we actually saw them in Deuteronomy 1 a couple of weeks ago, and Deuteronomy 3, 2. So there's encouragement to fight against Og because they had beaten Sihon. And on and on, many times the people of Israel in difficulty are encouraged that God will care for them. After all, they defeated Sihon and Og. Okay, and what's so big about Sihon and Og? Well, apparently they were considered to be powerful kings. And this put fear in the nations. Remember when Rahab was talking to the spies? She says, "Our hearts have melted because we heard about the Exodus." That was one thing. "And we heard about what you did to Sihon and Og." Okay, so these were the big dogs, and the land of Israel conquered them. It's especially striking in Psalm 135. I remember singing this actually in connection with the organization of a service, of a church. I think it was in Wichita. But the Psalm 135 says, you know, "Mighty Sihon, Og of Bashan, then the kings of Canaan fell. God their land gave to his people, willed it all to Israel." I think that's the red version, sorry. But that's a perfect psalm to sing for the organization of a church, because it reminds us that God's kingdom advances only when the kingdom of darkness is dispossessed. God's kingdom has to overthrow the kingdom of darkness, and that's the way it progresses. And I think we ought to add to our website, this is probably one of the few churches in town where you can come and sing about Sihon and Og, and two psalms that we have refer to that. So I was joking there. But this sense that the beginning has come to them. They are going to take over the dominion of even Sihon, the Amorite. Now, yeah, I mean, Samuel understands it. So, why is it that they took over his land, but not the lands of the others? And this is a good question, because it gets at some of the things that would naturally come up when we read later on about the utter destruction down to the children. So the posterity even of the Amorites is cut off here. why is it that this occurred? Why did God choose to dispossess the Amorites? And the answer is from 600 years ago. Okay, so turn to Genesis chapter 15. This was the original promise given to Abraham. It's actually not the first time that this sort of thing comes up. Genesis 15, and I'll read verses 13 through 16. This is that eerie setting where there's this lamp that passes through the animals that have been divided, and God says to Abram in verse 13 of Genesis 15, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs and will serve them, and they will afflict them for 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." And you notice then, I won't read the rest of it, but notice in verses 18 and following, "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates." So there you go. There's the bigger survey. And it lists the Kenites, the Kenizzites, and so on. The list of the ites that I was referring to before. But notice in particular, God says that they would be in Egypt for 400 years. God would bring them out of Egypt. And why is it that God is making Abraham and his descendants wait so long? Well, there could be various reasons. God is sovereign in his timing. But one reason that's given here is that the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Now, what was the iniquity of the Amorites? We can assume that it was complete by the time of Deuteronomy 2. And if you want some very unpleasant reading, and I'm not kidding, you could read in Leviticus 18 and later on in Deuteronomy 18, some of the sins of the Canaanites, including, that's broadly described, including the inhabitants of the land, broadly stated. So here are some of them. And these are things that are not usually mentioned in, whatever the right phrase is, in public, but this is what the Bible describes as some of the sins of the people of the land. Incest, adultery, child sacrifice, witchcraft, and above all, of course, idolatry. In fact, in Leviticus 18, it says, "Don't do what the people of the land have done, because it's for that reason that the land is," okay, sorry, but this is what the Bible says, "vomiting them out." The land is vomiting them out because of the perversions, because, in essence, the iniquity of the Amorites is full. And here, you know, it's sort of an equal opportunity warning, because God says if you do the things they do, the land will vomit you out too. And in fact, that's ultimately what happened to them. They fell in the pattern of behavior, if you want to call it that, of the Amorites. The iniquity of the Amorites had become full. They took their land, but later on, the nation's iniquity became full itself. So when God says he will dispossess these peoples, and he has in mind the horrible, horrible societal sins that are listed, and the rebellion against God, which their idolatry represented, which really underlay all of what they did. So that's the explanation of the repeated emphasis in Deuteronomy 2. You can go back to Deuteronomy 2 now. The repeated emphasis in Deuteronomy 2 that God is determined to destroy Sihon. Okay. So in case you didn't miss it, let me just highlight those. Verse 24, "Look, I have given into your hand Sihon the Amorite." Given into his hand. Verse 31, "I have begun to give Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to possess it." Verse 25, "I have put, this day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you upon the nations under the whole heaven." So there is a preparation in the sense that Sihon, who otherwise was known as the big dog in the neighborhood, began to fear these people who were coming through. And that actually, that putting the dread and fear of you is, as we already noticed, then grows with each conquest, so that later on the dread and fear is based not only on the Exodus, but on what they did to Sihon. Verse 30, God's purpose is shown in the fact that God says he has hardened his spirit, referring to Sihon, and made his heart obstinate. And in verse 33, the statement again that the Lord our God delivered him over to us. Okay. I wanted to read those to emphasize, in case you missed it, that this is God's sovereignty one more time. God is sovereign over the nations of Edom and Moab and Ammon, and that's why he can say, no, you can't have their land. God is sovereign over the land of Sihon, which is Heshbon, and God says, take their land. Their iniquity is full. So this passage emphasizes, in case you, again, I think it's pretty hard to miss, but emphasizes the sovereignty of God. And this is worth a little bit of reflection because, in particular, it mentions the hardening of the heart of Sihon. It's a wording quite similar to what's described in Exodus with Pharaoh. We'll come back to that. It also describes the utter destruction in verse 34, as I've already mentioned, down to the destruction of the children. So there are natural questions that come up when we read things like this. It's one thing to say, I believe in the sovereignty of God. It's another thing to read a passage like this in, you know, our nice, polite Sunday school where we're supposed to talk about kind things and not talk about vomiting and so on. But how is it that we should understand this? Well, first we should notice that there is quite a similarity to the language that's used in Exodus with regard to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's heart is said to be hardened in Exodus, and I put up a couple of references on the board down there somewhere, Exodus 7:3 and 10:27. Later on in Joshua 11, God says the same thing. In fact, it might be worthwhile for me to read that same passage, Joshua 11, 19 through 20, because God is going to repeat this same pattern. Whoops. That's because Joshua is not the same as Judges. Let's try that again. Joshua 11, 19 through 20. Sure, if I had a smartphone, that wouldn't happen. Okay. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them, and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. So Moses raised up Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Moses, you might say, raised up Sihon, and his heart was hardened. Moses will later on raise up one by one each of the kingdoms of Canaan, and their hearts are hardened. So how is it that God can do something like that? Well, the short answer is God can do it because God is sovereign. Okay, but it's important for us to keep in mind with the sovereignty of God that God is dealing with people who are already rebellious against him. That's why it's important to remember on the accounts in Exodus that Pharaoh hardened his heart. It's not a question of whether someone is a sinner or not. They're all sinners. They're all rebels against God. It's really a question of how someone could act so irrationally. I mean, have you ever thought about it? So you've just gone through 9 plagues, and you think, I'm ready for one more? You start to say, there must be something wrong with Pharaoh. How can he do this kind of thing? And it's the hardening of his heart. It's the fact that he cannot see that God is sovereign and refuses to submit to God, that God will get glory over him. We saw in Romans 1, right, that God gave over those who fell into idolatry, gave them over to worse sins. It's the same sort of thing. It's not as if they're considered pure and innocent and God twisted their arms so that they would sin, but God gave rebels over to further perversity. And it's the same thing we saw in Romans 9. I've already used, I guess, the language of Romans 9. God raising up Pharaoh to get glory for himself. I think Calvin summarizes pretty well in his commentary on the passage. God, by his secret inspiration, moves, forms, governs, and draws men's hearts so that even by the wicked he executes whatever he has decreed. At the same time, it is to be observed that the wicked are not impelled to hardness of heart by extrinsic force, but that they voluntarily harden themselves. so that in this same hardness of heart God may be seen to be a just judge. However incomprehensible his counsel may be, and however the impiety of men may betray itself, who are their own instigators and the authors of their own sin. So the fact that God determined to overthrow Sihon is really the key point of it. And it is the iniquity of the Amorites being full that's the proper context for understanding what we see here. There's still something more that needs to be talked about, and that I've already mentioned in connection with the destruction. Look at verse 34 of Deuteronomy 2. We took all his cities at that time, and we utterly destroyed the men, women, and little ones of every city. We left none remaining. Okay, so you can think of this as a sort of a purging of the land. And in fact, one of the explanations given for this sort of action as being necessary is that they would be defiled by the peoples. That was why they were supposed to do that sort of thing. And that's connected, no doubt, with what we saw in Leviticus 18. Don't do what they did because you'll be kicked out of the land just as they were. Now, the phrase that's translated in the New King James Version, utterly destroyed, do other people have other translations for that? Verse 34. Anyone there? We utterly destroyed the men, women, and little ones. Same phrase? Okay. It's almost a technical term in the original, which the word is cherem, H-E-R-E-M. I guess it's transliterated, which means to devote to destruction. So it's the same sort of thing that you see in the later descriptions. For example, and I put some references on the board. We are getting to the bottom of the board here. Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 20. The picture is really that these people are offered as a sacrifice to God. But it's not a holy sacrifice. It's being set apart to God for destruction. And the imagery then is those who are to be given over because of their wickedness so that no posterity should be left. Now, it's at this sort of thing that we start to wonder, well, how does this apply? How could this be? They were the agents of God's wrath. They acted by God's command. And notice the emphasis on that point in this passage. Over and over again, it's God who tells them what to do. And even at the end of the passage, it's they went exactly where God told us to. And where when God told us not to go to Ammon, we didn't go there because God had forbidden us to do that. So this is not some sort of ethnic cleansing that the Israelites took on themselves. This is human agents carrying out the wrath of God. And we need to remember when we think of that, that this was the wrath of God that had waited patiently 600 years. It's roughly 600 years from the time that that word had originally been given to Abraham. When God, in his forbearance, think again of Romans 2, withheld his hand of judgment, and yet now the iniquity is full, and God gives them over to that. One other thing which is, I think, quite striking in this passage, and then we'll think about how to work through it for us, is the offer of peace. I haven't said anything about that. Did you notice that? God tells Moses, you're going to destroy these people. And what does Moses do in, I lost my place here, in verse 26? I sent messengers from the wilderness of Kedemoth to Sihon, king of Heshbon, with words of peace. The initial approach wasn't, you have 24 hours to get out of town, like the old Western. It was, let me do exactly what I did with the other nations. I'm going to go to you. I will keep strictly to the road. I'm going to do just what we did with, it says here in verse 29, the descendants of Esau, Moab. Let's do the same thing. Okay? So the approach of Moses is not of war. The approach of Moses is a peaceful offer. We can trade, verse 28. We can buy your provisions. But that's the context of verse 30. But Sihon, king of Heshbon, would not let us pass through. And in fact, the initiative in the attack in verse 32 is Sihon. Sihon and all his people came out to fight. The ones who initiated the battle were not the Israelites. The ones who initiated the battle were the Amorites, Sihon and his kingdom. This emphasizes, again, a very important point, which is the distinction between God's sovereignty and our responsibility. It's not on us to work out the will of God except as he has commanded us to do. So this applies to the preaching of the gospel, for example. It's not to us to try to figure out who's elect and who's not elect. We're supposed to send the word of peace, if you will, the way Moses did, to all. It's God who is sovereign over all things. But it applies especially here because it emphasizes the fact that Moses acted only at God's command. Moses made peaceful overtures. It was through the sovereignty of God that those overtures were rejected and that the nation fought back against him, that Sihon rebelled against him. Now, how is this to be applied to our day? Well, let me remind you that the church is not supposed to take up the sword. Okay, so we don't need to cleanse Stillwater from all the things that would be disgusting to us. Instead, as Paul says in Ephesians 6, the weapons are... Sorry, starting to quote 2 Corinthians 10. Paul says in Ephesians 6 that we do not battle against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces. So spiritual forces use flesh and blood, that's certainly true, and we have many conflicts in the world because of it. But ultimately, even in the case of Sihon, the battle is a spiritual battle. And the weapons of the church are spiritual weapons. And the church needs to be ready to fight. That's an important lesson that we saw last week. But the church also needs to be ready to fight in obedience to God and using the weapons that God gives, and not using carnal weapons. Let me stop there and see if now I've been able to rile you up. You didn't say anything before. There we go. Okay, thank you. Vicki.
I'm just kidding. So the Amorite descendants of Ham?
I guess they would have been, yeah.
He was cursed by God.
Right. The Canaanites were, and they're usually included among them. Yeah. You have to look at the Table of Nations in Genesis 10, but I think that's right. Any Bible experts want to correct me on that? Yep.
Are there any other historical documents that mention Sihon and Og?
No, I don't think so. None that I ran across in my reading. I guess at this time, some of the other world powers were not in as much in evidence, so Egypt was pretty far removed from there. So usually those mentions come, like with Assyria and Babylon and so on, because they tended to rout all of those local kings. But I don't know of any. Yeah, Jeff.
When you ask your question about why God left them there 400 years, the other thing I thought of was this, besides what you mentioned, was that they sort of prepared the ground.
Yeah.
So
right.
in four chapters or something, he's tell them that they live in houses that they didn't build and take olives from trees they didn't plant and so on.
Right. And they already, in this passage, start to inherit that. But that's an excellent point. The wealth of the wicked is laid up for the righteous. Proverbs
13.
Okay. Sure, you could find it faster than I can with your smart thingy. Anyway, yeah, that's right.
By the way, if you had a smartphone, then you might not get Judges and Joshua mixed up with the same chapter, but I know one time I was using a computer Bible, and I was doing on Exodus or something, and I went on to the next book and didn't realize it. I was like, going on to the next book. It was just showing verse numbers or something, not chapter numbers.
Right, right. I guess if you're like you're punching in with your thumb a J, you might hit Judges instead of Joshua too. But they happen to be right by each other. Yeah, that's a very good point. And of course, another factor in that is that God would increase their numbers from just Abraham and his household to the battle force they had. He also reduced them over 40 years, but he prepared them for battle. That's very good. Yeah, that point is a very good one for the, as Jeff was saying, for the later part of the book, where God says, I'm bringing you into something that's already set up for you, and you need not to trust in your own power to get wealth, but remember that God provided. So really no one wants to complain about utter destruction or hardening the heart? You guys are a bunch of militant people. Yes.
I do have a question about how these names... I mean, I don't really... It's not clear in my mind what you actually mean by human sacrifices.
Oh, in Leviticus 18, it's referring to child sacrifice. So they killed their children to give to their gods.
No, I mean...
Is that what you mean?
How Sihon's people...
Oh.
Would be considered, I mean, all of them were wiped out. Is that a...
Oh, how is that a...
In what sense is that a human sacrifice?
It's in the term itself in the Hebrew. It has the idea of setting apart to God. So just like sacrifices are set apart to God. So I don't mean... Although one commentary said the Israelite army was like priests or something, that's probably taking it a bit too far. It's not that sort of thing. But it is the sense that these people are doomed to destruction, but it's the idea of being set apart to destruction. So there's a kind of a consecration involved, but it's a horrible consecration, because it's a consecration to utter destruction. And that's the sense in which it's like a sacrifice, because the sacrifices were set apart to God. And that, I mean, you can see that even in Joshua, like when they took spoil that was supposed to be set apart to God, that was a serious thing. So in some cases there was utter destruction like this. In some cases there were, like the women and children were left. Sometimes everything was gone. I mean, they had to, they were supposed to take the gold the way it was taken. So it is a sense of consecration, but... And that's the reason why the word sacrifice is sometimes used in connection with it. Does that help?
Yes, it
Maybe
does.
The word sacrifice isn't very helpful, but it is the idea of setting apart to God.
This is, in a certain sense, a holy duty.
Right, that's why it's called holy war. Although, I mean, since 9/11, when we talk about holy war, I think we all sort of cringe, because now the Christians are going to start blowing themselves up in mosques or something. But it's... It is that sense, yeah. It is God's holy war. The iniquity is full, and God's going to destroy them. That's the basic point.
So what sort of terminology do we use when we're talking to people who could be categorized as liberal theologians, when they accuse Bible believing Christians of advocating ethnic cleansing?
I don't know that... Are we accused of that?
Yes. I mean, I have heard, this kind of thing, this kind of destruction, at kind of wiping out of the Ammonites.
Right. Well, okay. I mean, or of the Crusades or something like that. Yeah. I think it is important to realize that God had a particular purpose in history to do this. Maybe I didn't emphasize this enough, but it was at the command of God. Okay, this is not a standing command of God that you're just supposed to go out and dispossess whatever nation you think is impure. It is a particular point in history that's given to us, again, as sort of a type for the expansion of the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. But it's clear that the church is the force in the kingdom of God is not supposed to be expanded by means of the sword. So I guess that would be the short answer, and I don't want to talk about the Crusades. That's another sort of thing. But that's the short historical answer, and that separates the Bible from the Quran in the clear sense that this is not an ongoing duty of the church. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
Jeff was going to say something.
Well, I don't know if it was going to help. My question was similar to Liz's, in that I do think this is something that apologetics is they were commanded to do this, kill all the children, and I tend to think since it doesn't bother me, but I think it's partly just because I've read it so many times and included that was God's decision, but I think if you think about thinking of coming to it fresh, it does really shock the jar. And,
that was why I was only kidding a little bit when I said you guys didn't, jump up. And when I started talking about this, like, this is disturbing. It should be disturbing, I think.
So we have a big effort here for pro-life.
Sure.
There's sort of a one-off example.
Right. Well, I think it is a reminder that when we talk about the sanctity of life is defined by God. And so that's why I tried to emphasize the sovereignty of God. So God is the one who decides who lives and who doesn't. He does it in perfect consistency with his justice, but the killing of unborn children is against the law of God and is therefore forbidden. This special situation, the killing of this entire society was commanded by God. And Calvin actually goes on quite a bit in his sermons on this point, that in the end, what we have to do is resign ourselves and say God is sovereign and he's able to determine these things. And that, in terms of apologetics, that's why the presuppositional apologetics is a very important point, because you don't dance around it and say, well, it was pretty bad, but, they were really bad, and you sort of weigh things out. No, you say God has the right to determine these things, and I'm not going to try to justify God. Just like Paul says in Romans 9, who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Ultimately, we have to say that kind of thing. But we also should explain that this is not, you might say, the standing law of God, but a special situation where it was intended to actually point us to the eternal destruction that comes on those who rebel against God. That's really the utter destruction that ultimately points to hell. Has serious consequences. So I'm not sure I could really, in a sense, give a defense of it beyond falling back on the justice and sovereignty of God. You don't want to say God is arbitrary, but is that?
Yeah, I think it's a hard thing.
It is a hard thing, and I think this is what people who know something about the Bible will bring up from the Bible in discussions about.
Well, I have one more question, but I'll ask you later.
They are at the gates or whatever. So, I'm glad you finally. So let's close in.